there a doctor in the house?
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
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 And doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
Advanced medicine is officially underway. Dr. Batar, welcome, my friend. I missed you in Chicago, of course, over the weekend, but hopefully we can get you at the Trinity Conference in the spring in L.A. It would be great to have all of those folks who appreciate you on the show see you in person. It's been a while.
Well, I would love to be there. That's one place that I have never lectured at before, and so it would be nice to be there, actually. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, so I think no matter what anybody says about you, I'm going to make sure they invite you. You know how that
Perfect.
Goes.
I'm looking forward to it, Robert.
Excellent.
You know, it's almost like it reminds me of that, you know, in college or high school when you crash a party.
Yeah.
That, I don't know why that thought just crossed my mind. I could just crash it like a party and show up.
Well, yeah, why not? Actually, you know, you were there, I'd get you on stage with me anyway, so it'd be fun regardless. But yeah, we'll see what we can do about that. But our commitment to health freedom and the people that listen to us around the world, I think they understand the importance from a deep spiritual level, as well as all the way out to the physical reality, that the freedom to, you know, create your own path, or, you know, basically co-create your own path in life. And that includes the creation of disease, which often helps us to learn the things we didn't know we wanted or needed to learn. And then, of course, the path out of the mess that we were participant in creating. And I think, you know, that concept of self-responsibility is not a bad one, although a lot of people don't like the R word. I do, because it really opened me up to the possibilities that the expert said, nah, that can't happen. You can't grow out of that. You can't heal from that. And a lot of people are dealing with those situations.
Well, I'm going to be a little bit politically incorrect.
Oh no!
And,
oh, don't
and
do it.
Not me, right? Not you.
Yes.
And me. We're always politically correct. No.
Right.
This is actually something important. You said you like the R word, the personal responsibility.
Responsibility? Yeah. Because I know what it, how it manifested different from when I felt like I was a victim of everything that happened, you know, to me, so to speak, instead of what I was participating in, even unknowingly.
Right. Right. And so I'm going to disagree with you. I don't like that word, responsibility.
Okay.
I completely 100% agree with you that that is absolutely a necessity. There's no negotiation on it. You have to take personal responsibility to get better.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean necessarily that I like it, you know, because now I'm holding myself accountable and responsible,
yeah,
which is often a hard thing for people to do. And I think that's probably where we end up having that human factor of self-sabotage.
Mm.
So I don't – but if you – I think it's crucial. I think it's necessary. And I think that there's no other way of doing it. So I am a big, big stickler, as you know. You know, I drive myself. I drive those that are around me,
mm-hmm,
with that responsibility.
And I'm not saying, Dr. Batar, that I've ever not complained about it. Believe me, I have. I mean, it's like, oh, man, I got to do that, right? But at the same time, you know, if I weigh the two scenarios out, one where I didn't know that I had the opportunity to heal myself or work with others that would empower me to heal myself, versus just remaining a victim and saying, well, it's not my responsibility. The doctor will take care of me. Of course, even if there are days when I go, gosh, you know, I just, can somebody else do this, right? At the same time, I've been there long enough to go, yeah, I'll toy with the thought for a moment, but it's fleeting. I'll get over it, and then I'll get on with my responsibility.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. I just wanted to make sure that I distinguish, so those that are listening to us don't think that we're both mutants, because I'm not a mutant. I don't like the responsibility. I just know that it's essential to get healthy, and it's actually essential in all aspects of life, whether you're talking about it from an education standpoint, a business standpoint, a spiritual educational standpoint, you know, your mm-hmm. children, how you raise them, their outcome. It's all your own personal responsibility. And so I think that for people that are listening to us, Robert, it's an important message that when you and I talk about it, you know, people have said to me, at least, you know, you guys make it sound easy. I remember about 15 years ago, a patient of mine said, Dr., you always preach about exercise. You know, it's easy for a person like you. You're one of the beautiful people. And I said, what was that?
Wait a second.
Said,
were they looking at you?
No, exactly. That was my question. But they were talking about when they said the beautiful people, I said, yeah. I asked them, I said, what are you talking about? What does that mean? They said, you know, the people that are, you know, fit and good looking, and this is, it's easy for you guys to go to the gym, but for people like us, you know, we don't like the, and I'm like, what do you mean, people like beautiful people like, what are you talking about? And so in this individual's mind, he had conjured up this image of people that were fit as being the beautiful people, and it was easy for them because they liked it. And I told him, I said, you meet me at the gym, okay? And he actually did. A few weeks later, he met me at the gym. And I wanted him to see the misery on my face. I said, I hate working out. I absolutely detest it. Now, I love the feeling afterwards. Post-workout feeling is like, it's like a drug. You get addicted to it. But the actual working out, I said, you just come and watch. And he did. It was a 35, 40-minute workout, very intense, very fast, in a lot of pain. And he told me, he said, he goes, you weren't kidding. He goes, you look like you're in a lot of pain. I said, I am in a lot of pain. That's why I hate it. So it was important for, I think it's important for us. And it was important for me then to realize that people that see you and I and doing our thing and us preaching about it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, actually 25 hours a day, 8 days a week, they think that this is, you know, it's easy for us. It's not easy for anyone, but this is part of the human state. We have to overcome our own resistance and move into that resistance and do what's necessary. And that means taking personal responsibility. So even for the rest of the world, whoever's listening, it may be easy for Robert and he likes that. I don't necessarily like it, but I know it's essential to be better, to get better, and to stay better. To stay
well, I remember you saying this, and you've said it often, once difficult, now easy. And you know, that is the thing is, you can float in and out of that too, right? Because it's not a permanent now easy, because there's any point in time we have the freedom to go, you know what, enough of that easy stuff. I'm gonna back off for a while. And then, of course, it's a little bit difficult to get back into it. But I do find that if you've done it once, it is marginally, at least, easier to get back to it, because you have a pathway, there's a pattern emerged, there's body memory, things like that. And, you know, to your advantage. But yeah, the hardest thing is the first time, if somebody looks at you and says, I just couldn't do that. Maybe like this person who then went with you and maybe was encouraged that, you know what, it's not that he's like, you know, got superpowers, but maybe the will was strong enough to overcome that. I don't want to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Now, here's something talking about will. You're like, this is perfect volleying it back and forth, because you're bringing up certain key points that are actually, I was just writing a chapter in the conflict book. So these are points that are coming up. There was an experiment done years ago, and I can't remember the name of the researcher's first name was Paul something, but he actually wrote another type of book similar to Maxwell Maltz's book on psychocybernetics. He actually wrote a book that had a similar title, but it was before Maxwell Maltz's book became popular. He's a British researcher. And in that book, he talked about willpower and how we associate willpower with being the most powerful aspect of self-development and self-improvement. But in actuality, he found that willpower always will be defeated, and usually easily defeated, when it's pitted against imagination. So even though your willpower is not to eat the cake, your imagination overrides that urge not to eat the cake, because it imagines that how that delicious chocolate melts in your mouth and blah, blah, blah. So one of the techniques that he talked about, which I'm actually going to elaborate on, is how you use imagination to help enhance your willpower. And so this is the four-step process that you probably remember this, Robert, when we were in San Diego 2 years ago at that at
the Best Answer for Cancer,
Yeah, as you were sitting there, remember when they were filming me and I went through my step process, my program of how to accomplish anything? Do you remember that, the seven steps? And
I don't remember all that sequence, but I know that you are. It's very exciting when you bring up this issue, because that's been my point for many years about willpower, because people, I think, overemphasize it, and it can easily be defeated, like you said, with imagination. But this exact same thing that you're doing is that you can enhance willpower with imagination too, or you could sabotage it. Either way, the power to what? Imagine, co-create, all of that is yours, and using imagination is one of the most powerful ways to overcome those limitations or patterns in the path from the past.
Absolutely. So there's actually a four-step sequence, and I've narrowed it down to four. I had seven steps, and seven steps is actually, there's a longer version too, but again, making things simple stupid is I think a key goal that at least I have, so that more people can actually start to use it. And sometimes having the knowledge is one thing, but to act upon that knowledge is more difficult. So to keep it simpler makes it more actionable. But I'm not going to go over that right now, because for those people that come to our webinar that's on October 4th, I will, if somebody asks me, I'll give them the four steps. It's going to be part of the book, so I don't want to give it out I don't like to put out things too early, as far as specific things like that, because once I've published it, then nobody can say that it was theirs. And so that's my ego coming into the picture. But anyway, I will I will share that with anybody who comes to the webinar on October 4th.
Excellent.
But it's really, really important, I think, that we take that responsibility to make sure we allow people to understand, hey, it's not easy, which, you know, I think we just did today for the probably the first time. But that component that you said, once difficult, now easy, that you said the second time it's easier. I'll tell you, the second time may not be easy. Even the third time may not be easier. But you will find that if you just do it within that old adage, 21 days to form a habit, I say 28 days just to give that 7 days extra buffer. Mm-hmm. But you do something every day for 28 days, I guarantee you that on the 29th day, when you do it, you will, and you think back, you accurately think back to when you started, you will realize it was far, far easier. So it may not be this a second or third time, but once difficult, now easy, it's that the body gets used to it. The body starts to expect it. It you've overcome the natural resistance not to do something because you formed that habit. It's no different than brushing your teeth or getting up and, you know, whatever habits that you have. If you have a habit of not brushing your teeth, then that's a bad thing, and you're going to, you know, miss your teeth later on. But my point is that it's the habit that you get into, in that habitual, ritualistic action becomes almost automatic. In martial arts, for example, we learn certain movements, and we have to repeat them and over again. And sometimes it becomes pretty monotonous, and, you know, you're thinking, why do I have to keep on doing this? I'd like to learn the next move. The reason is because we're developing muscle memory.
Yes.
So you don't have to think about it. You don't have to cognitively think about it. It's all subconscious, just like your heart's beating. And
right.
So this is what we're talking about, developing that subconscious automation.
Your mind and the imagination is instantaneous in many ways. It's, you know, it moves at the speed of light or beyond the speed of light, okay? But the body does not. If it did, it'd be ripped apart, right? So there are laws that apply here that make you feel like you're moving through molasses to get there. But the Creator set it up this way for a reason. You want to fight it, that's your deal. But I try to work with it eventually, because if you keep pushing and pushing, beating your head against that same brick wall, it's going to bleed just as much the first time as the 10th until you're out of blood. Listen, we got more advanced medicine to come right after this break.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
In the health world through the power of radio, it's the Robert Scott Bell Show.
All the links are up in the show notes. Thanks to Superdon. RobertScottBell.com. Take you to advancedmedicine.com. You can learn more about Dr. Bitar also at drbitar.com. Dr. Bitar, becoming a physician, as you have a DOMD, you go through certain things. There's, I would call them hazing rituals. Go through residency. There's an article here about residency burnout. Physicians, nearly half are reporting burnout. I'm surprised it's only half. Honestly, I've had friends that have been through it. I kind of know what they go through. I'm thinking, what is the advantage of going through it this way? Is it about breaking down the barriers of the mind so you no longer question what you're being told? Or is there something else there that sleep deprivation and all the things that happen during residency are a benefit to doctors later in their career?
You know, Robert, it's interesting you said that. I honestly think now, compared to then, I actually believe that it's part and parcel of the strategy that was implemented when, or probably before, the Flexner Report came out and before the entire medical educational process was turned upside down, and when homeopathy and other methods that were non-pharmaceutical based were ridiculed and start to be pushed down the alternative route as opposed to being the primary route, the primary modality. Mm-hmm. I think it's part and parcel of that whole strategy, because if you can take a group of people, single them out, put them under undue stress, have them survive it, you know, let them weed their own process out, but you have them, the ones that survive it are now elevated in a position of authority, elevation from a societal level, you know, put on a pedestal, and basically told that their poop doesn't stink, then you can actually now make them feel that they're special, and then give them the give them the power to wield certain tools. So it's almost like taking prison guards and elevating them, or taking the certain prisoners and elevating them by giving them some authority. And so now they feel that they have authority over the rest of the people, and anybody that doesn't cater to them, it's probably a bad analogy. I know.
Well, no, you. The thing is, you've been through basic training, right, in the Army?
Yes, absolutely. I've gone through all the stuff. So
yeah,
and all that stuff.
So I think about that, and I say, all right, there's a very strong purpose and reason for doing that, you know, to mold a soldier, you know, into existence, right? But if you apply the, as we have over the years, this allopathic thought form in medicine, attack, kill, destroy, which is, you know, the methods for the most part, then it makes sense why the Pentagon basically can go in and take over medical education, and it'd be almost the same thing. Like you said, you're going through this hazing ritual, brutal, and you survived it. Now you're part of the special elite club or group. So I think what you're saying is right. The question is there anything we can find that was a benefit, you know, from that? I mean, did they learn to become a doctor better because of it, or could they have done it without that hazing?
Well, actually, so this is really interesting. You brought this analogy up in the military when you brought up the basic training, because, you know, basic training is only 6 weeks. But I just, when I mentioned the Q course to this or that, you just actually solidified that thought process in my head, because when you start looking at things like, okay, you look at the Rangers, right, or the Special Forces, the Green Berets. So I didn't go through Ranger school, but I did, you know, that I was SF, but I didn't go through Ranger school. But I'll tell you, Ranger School and SF, at least from the Army, those are the two hardest courses to go through. I mean, you've got the Northern Warfare and Pathfinder and all these other military elite courses that they have. But Ranger and SF, the Green Berets, okay, those are the Q course for the SF. Mm-hmm. Those are the two hardest. Now, they're very different. They say the Ranger School, it's a physical, they basically physically F you. That's what the, you know, they basically physically abuse you to go through the process. With the Q course, with the SF, it's more a mental FU, as I put it. You know, it's a mental torture that you go through. So both of them are designed a little bit differently, because with the SF's mission is to go in and they basically live with the people and they indoctrinate the people. And so, you know, you live there for months, you may dress like them. People can actually go by without even knowing that you are a part of the military, part of the U.S. Armed Forces. Whereas with the Rangers, you know, you go in the mission, you come back out, basically kind of like a seek and destroy type of thing, a seek and, you know, do a mission, come back out. Mm-hmm. So when you talked about the basic training aspect, it made because basic training, every soldier has to go through it. So it's nothing like, you know, basic training and then officer training. Every soldier, any enlisted person and or officer has to go through one of those two programs. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't thinking of that as being elite, but certainly with the higher courses,
it is like to weed people out, though, is it not?
That's exactly what it is. And here's the thing: it also teaches resilience and teaches responsibility to those people. And so, usually, you will never find somebody that's a Ranger or SF or, you know, some other elite force that walks around strutting. You rarely ever find that, because
stand by. We got to strut into a break. I'm sorry. We'll be back with more Advanced Medicine. Fascinating discussion with Dr. Rasha Bittar on his Army background as well as it relates to modern medicine. Stick with us.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. Rocking the health world through the power of radio. It's the Robert Scott Bell Show.
So, Dr. Bittar, I'm fascinated by, again, that journey to becoming, you know, an excellent artisan in any field, right? You know, in homeopathy, you typically will study historically, and it's true of many fields, like an apprentice relationship to a master teacher, and you're put through the metal, so to speak. And you know, it takes a long time to get there, and by the time you are ready, then they spit you out, kick you out, whatever, and now you're on your own, and you apply the skills you've learned in your own unique way. Obviously, in the Army, they don't want necessarily you to stick your head up above anybody else. It's a little different there. But the concept of weeding out, making sure you can deal with it, the stress, whatever, you did mention at the last segment, resilience and responsibility, two R words at the end of this thing. Is this maybe the positive side of this? I'm looking for something.
Well, actually, I think that's what happens when you take the training into a certain realm. And that's why I was mentioning before we went to break that I've never seen anybody that's gone through any of these types of training programs that go around strutting. Usually they're pretty reserved, pretty laid back. They're humble, if at all, because they've been humbled going through the process.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, they have a greater appreciation, at least the people that I've come across. The ones that I have seen that have kind of, been boisterous and stuff, very rare, but they usually, they've just got some kind of a other flaw going on, or they,
But the whole idea of wearing you down is part of it. And I think that, you're going to wear down resistance, because as we know, the physician community by and large is when they come out of that, they most of them don't ask these questions that we ask today, or that I asked even early on. I didn't want to subject myself to, because I knew I would not cooperate with those that tell me not to ask questions, not to look at those things, observe them, and point them out. Absurdities. Of course, they don't want that. They want you to be able to basically do what you're told. This is your training. You're going to prescribe drugs, and again, I don't mean to limit it, but it's an interesting analogy trying to assess this.
Well, I think that if you look at pretty much all elite training programs, no matter what, whether it's military or whether it's educational or spiritual or whatever, mm-hmm. Like look at what type of hardships they put priests through, and the high incidence of all these weird
aberrant behaviors. Yeah, the manifest
aberrant behavior, right? Yeah. Because they're pushing them into that extreme where they're trying to get to a certain level. In fact, this would be an interesting chart to see that these three different elite training programs, if you will. You've got the priesthood, mm-hmm. you've got medical education, and you've got the elite military services.
Yeah.
And you can see the strange behaviors, aberrant
behaviors that can manifest.
Yeah.
Of course, they shouldn't be and wouldn't be tolerated in the military, because they'd be drummed out, I think, much quicker because of the tight discipline and the observation.
But they'd probably be castrated and hung out.
Right.
But my point is, if you look at all three are trying to take people, individuals, humans, into extreme situations to develop some type of, to gain some type of a result. There's got to be some reason for that. And so you see a extreme on the priest side, you see another extreme on the opposite spectrum on the military side, and then you see this thing in the middle, in the medicine. You don't see this aberrant type behavior necessarily in the medical side, but my point is that you do see, this interesting observational components, and it's kind of hitting me all at one time, because if you think about it, it falls right in the middle. You do have the resilience aspect, and you do have an improvement in the thought process aspect. It's the endurance aspect. If you have to go 36 hours without sleep, and you do that throughout residency, or every other day, or every third day you take call, and you're in this situation, your body forms that habit again, because I need so much sleep. I need 8 hours, 10 hours of sleep. But suddenly how much sleep I normally get. I get more sleep now than I ever have, and sometimes I feel like I'm on overload because I get so much sleep. But compared to most people, 4 hours or 5 hours of sleep is not enough sleep. But again, my body got used to it during my general surgery training, and actually in the military during some of the courses, that's one of the things they do. They deprive you of food and they deprive you of sleep.
Yeah.
So your body gets used to it, for a couple of months during the training processes. So I think it's a conditioning.
But then you are, it's conditioning. But of course, just like any conditioning and programming, it opens the mind for suggestion. And perhaps that's the big reason why, because they need people to behave a certain way in order for what their goals are to be achieved. So I get that. And that's perhaps why it's different in holistic medical circles. We would say, that's kind of absurd, because that goes in the opposition of what we're trying to teach people in order for healing to occur. We don't want to, keep you awake for days on end. Although starvation part of it is good, because fasting is something that is helpful to the body and mind.
Yeah, but you got to remember, though, whose agenda is being exercised here. So those that are trying to... For example, anytime you want to single out a group of people and have them do your bidding, you want to isolate them into a group, you want to elevate them, you want to have them go through something that forms that exclusivity, that bond within them, and makes them feel that they're special. A lot of times you don't have to necessarily do anything to make them feel special. When you've jumped out of a plane at 36,000 feet and then, you at nighttime, you form that natural camaraderie, or you feel that you've got a notch on your belt that most of the people will never do. And so that naturally builds that exclusivity within mm-hmm. that group. And then you can start to, as you said, you've conditioned them. Now you can introduce certain ideas. So there were certain things I did in the military and certain things that friends of mine did in the military for God and country. Yeah. Now, after we were out, we realized it wasn't for God and country. It was because we were being told to follow an agenda that some politician had come up with right. that had nothing to do with serving God and country. Yeah. So, but you condition people this way. And I think, you know, we've gone into a very interesting topic here, Robert. I don't know how we ended up here, but this is,
I like
you know,
it.
It's not, we see this military, medicine, mm-hmm. You know, the priesthood. I would suspect that it's probably with every type of organization.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even like look at the medical societies individually, you know, you've got ICIM and ACAM and all these organizations, which are promoting, a non-conventional medical treatment regimen.
Yes.
And yet, even within them, they've got their own political aspects, and you start seeing how they kind right. of create these things within doctors, you know, if they aren't yeah, taking this subcourse.
The concept of indoctrination, of yeah, course, exactly. has its root there. Now, think about how long it takes to overcome that. We're 100 years out, Dr. Bitar, from the Spanish influenza pandemic of, believe it or not, 1918. We're at 2018. Think about 100 years later. Now, what have we learned in 100 years? If you're in modern medicine and really, you know, been conditioned, you believe, man, all we are just one vaccine away from never letting that happen again, versus someone who's outgrown that conditioning or programming. You say, my gosh, it wasn't a lack of antibodies at that point in time. It was about the destruction of the terrain during World War I, the exposure, including vaccinations, experimental vaccines that were given, and the allopathic suppressive treatments like aspirin that were given that resulted in high mortality. When you cross-reference it to homeopaths and naturopaths at the time in their treatment, you saw a near 100% survival rate. And so, you know, bringing this training and this education or indoctrination into play 100 years later, we're still struggling for modern medical doctors to see these realities that they're not seeing yet.
Yeah, and I think this comes back down to, again, that conditioning and how a group can be conditioned. And when I say a group, you know, you can be, it can be a group of 10 soldiers, or it can be, you know, 6.5 million, billion people on the planet. They mm-hmm, can be conditioned. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's exactly what it comes down to. I had a very interesting conversation when I was in Singapore with a pretty educated and informed lady who was pro-vaccine. She doesn't have any young children now, but she, you know, she said, oh, I understand that people, you know, say this, but, you know, you'll never convince me. And then we went and had a discussion. And at the end of it, she said, you've really opened my eyes. And she said, but I had no idea some of these things. And the reason she didn't have any of these ideas is because the media doesn't talk about them. She had no understanding or awareness. I gave the example of the, you know, hepatitis B, took her through that little thing that I like to do that you've seen me do before on stage, where I argue with doctors. I mean, the more medical education somebody has, the more the hepatitis B argument they can't argue with it, because it's basic fundamental understanding of, you know, basically the heart pumps the blood through the body, and then when you take it through the hepatitis B and the insanity of how we give it and when we give it, etc., nobody can refute it. You know, like, do we really expect our children to be IV drug users, prostitutes, or doctors or nurses by the time they're age 10? And of course the answer is no. So why are we doing hepatitis B when that's the only population that it affects? And we know that the hepatitis B has to be given every 10 years. So that type of rationale, when you start taking a person through that and you start to educate them and make them aware, and you basically are deconditioning them,
yes,
or you're actually deprogramming them, right? Or you're actually allowing them an opportunity to deprogram themselves so they can discover the truth for themselves. I have found that when you allow a person and help a person to discover the truth themselves, this is something yes. my dad taught me a long time ago, they are far easier to convince, and they're far easier for them to digest it and now to change or to evolve.
It's a very good point.
Because they came to the conclusion themselves,
yeah.
as opposed to it being shoved down their throat.
Well, yeah, you force somebody into a new state of consciousness. Is it really a new state of consciousness, or is it something they'll discard the moment they're out of sight, right? You know,
yeah.
this is the thing. And is there a way? And I think what we do here on this show, what I love to do, is engage in intellectual discussion, but also, you know, we laugh a lot. We bring humor into it, point out absurdities.
I don't laugh about anything.
No, of course not you. I didn't mean you. But but everybody else,
right.
We just, and it makes so-called the medicine go down easier a little bit, right? The spoonful, proverbial spoonful of sugar. But the idea here is, of course, to, as I say, not convince anybody, but to, you know, perhaps put these things out there. And if something strikes a chord of truth that you sense it, then you'll be encouraged to go further, dig deeper, and maybe despite your own protestations, we'll go, you know, I have to admit, that kind of made sense. I better dig it a little deeper, like this experience you just shared.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, talks about how 10,000 hours of doing something is actually at the point where things become, you know, you become extraordinary at that point, yeah. Once you've hit that 10,000 hours of doing something. Mm-hmm. And I have found that that probably, while we were talking, it came to my mind that that's probably that once difficult, now easy concept. And of course, you don't have to do something 10,000 hours before it becomes easy. The point is to become really good at something, like extraordinary something. You need to have that 10,000 hours.
Right.
And so this whole concept that we've just talked about, this conditioning aspect and then the deconditioning and you know, what is the motive behind it? Maybe that's why the 10,000 hours, you know, by putting a person through those types of hardships during the medical education program,
yeah.
It conditions them a certain way. And so maybe we should strive to do 10,000 hours of certain things to really get good. And maybe that's what my new goal would be, to make sure that I have 10,000 hours of documented time. And in fact, Robert, this is an interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
For a couple of years, you remember when I used to keep a daily ledger of how many push-ups and how many
yes.
sit-ups and stuff I did?
Yes.
Okay, well, you know, I know I hit that 10,000 hours because that was, you know, whatever it was for those 3 years. I hit the 10,000 hours.
You know,
I need to do it again, I think.
We're working on 10,000 hours here of advanced medicine. By then, we'll actually be really good at this.
Yeah, we're almost hitting 1,000 hours now, right?
Yeah, no, we're cranking. All right, listen, we got to take a break. We'll be back and we'll be wrapping up Advanced Medicine with Dr. Rasha Bittar here on the Robert Scott Bell Show. Check it out. Links are up, and there's loads more to learn for all of us.
Live around the world,
the Robert Scott Bell Show.
Robert Scott Bell Show.
Archives available at our home and broadcast radio syndication, GCN, GCNlive.com. And then, of course, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, UK Health Radio, and, of course, YouTube, and AdvancedMedicine.com, DrBittar.com, and which is where you, by the way, Advanced Medicine, where you're going to find out about the October 4th webinar that Dr. Bittar is going to be running. If you're already a member of the IDFW, you are in. If not, you need the invitation code 1358. Go to AdvancedMedicine.com. It'll be hopefully pretty obvious how to do that.
Yeah, it'll be pretty obvious, and if it's not, just look in the left-hand tab. Off the dashboard, and there's a tab that says education,
mm-hmm.
and just simply click on that, and there's a tab there for advanced medicine. It's under health education on the left hand side, and you can just go down there, and it'll have a link there.
Yeah, and once you sign up, you'll be getting email links, so you'll be part of it. Now let's squeeze in one question of the day before we break here.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
All right, this is for Dr. Bittar and me. Hi, I was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer on my bones last year. Now, Dr. Bittar, this is coming from someone named Dr. Khan, K-H-A-N. And I don't know what kind of doctor, but this person says I have been following alternative protocols as well as endocrine treatments from conventional medicine. So I have some kind of hormonal blocking. You'll have to kind of speculate there. Symptoms on disease improved, but still not in complete remission. What do you think I should add to my protocol to improve my gut health, especially SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which my alternative doctor diagnosed and gave me a few weeks treatment, but after stopping the treatment, it came back. Please help. So Dr. Khan is requesting some kind of assistance here.
That's actually my mother's maiden name, K-H-A-N. That's interesting. The only reason I brought that up is because yesterday was her anniversary of when she passed away, and so kind of strange how
there's
a signal there from the universe.
She's not sending a message from beyond. Is she at this point? I don't know. It could be. But regardless, I mean, listen, I don't know what endocrine disrupting treatments that the oncologists do. You know, you hear about these things. You might know more about them. But concerns me, of course, if there's a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, that you want to address that without destroying the patient.
Yeah, I think that that's a very important point. So the gist of the question was that they wanted to know what else they can do. So basically, they obviously have been pursuing a direction that is the correct direction. When you start talking about the endocrine system and doing certain types of treatments that were just mentioned, you know, they cause a lot of disruption. There's a lot of stuff that ends up happening from an endocrine standpoint in cancer overall. And when we start to muck around with that, for example, putting people on steroids to reduce inflammation, that's what the thought process is. But then we suppress the immune system, that's affecting the endocrine system, obviously.
Or the estrogen blockers, because they talk about estrogen dominance, but they don't address why it happens. They just suppress it after the fact. And, you know,
absolutely. Yeah. And actually, the problem is that a lot of these drugs are xenoestrogenic anyway. So you've got, you know, not only the natural exposures of things that we're taking, like exposed to plastics and such, where we get the xenoestrogens, but we've got the phytoestrogens and the soy. Mm-hmm. And so then you've got these pharmaceutical medications that are also have a very high estrogenic effect. So you've got an estrogen dominance going on there. And so anyway, there's a lot of different endocrine manipulations that are attempted in all individuals, not just cancer patients. But then we start to, generally speaking, when I say we, the medical community generally starts to muck everything up by getting into those types of components. If anything, we should support the endocrine system with natural supportive measures and to help the body deal with the stress. But we have to be very conscientious and careful and be very judicious at making sure we don't violate the negative inhibitory feedback.
Yeah, and these drug interventions can disrupt the gut ecology, and that's where we can see SIBO. The terrain is altered. Now, I always recommend the Silver Aloe Protocol. It's not mutually exclusive. There are a lot of things that can be done. There are homeopathics as well. I think we talked before air, and you said you have done some things for SIBO that are maybe formulations that people can access. I don't know, but you know, healing the gut, replenishing the microbiome is going to be important here.
Yeah, actually, the things that we've developed, again, we don't even talk about it. Why? Because if it's indicated, the HeadMap picks it up. So that's one reason. It's actually our i7
So Dr. Khan should plug into the IADFW so that Dr. Khan can plug into the HeadMap and find out what's next.
Exactly. Well, actually, somebody can go into a HeadMap without having to plug into IADFW, but IADFW allows you to actually have access to certain things that make the HeadMap that much more effective, because it gives them access to the protocols. But you're absolutely right. I think the last thing that the question, which was, you know, what can we do? I think you just answered, Robert. That's probably the best place to start. There are other things that can obviously be done.
And you know what? The other thing is just to tell them what they need to know, because we're out of time.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry. Yeah. Well, the power to heal is unequivocally each and every one of yours and ours.
Beautiful.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.